Clem extended a dripping spoon upward toward him, and he bent hastily to take the offered mouthful before it fell off. It was delicious, bursting sweet and creamy on the tongue. "Mmm," he said, swallowing. "Well, let's not tell Mummy or Granny, shall we? They've this odd prejudice toward meat and vegetables." Jem nodded, agreeable, and offered him another spoonful. They consumed the bowl together in a companionable silence, after which Jem crawled into his lap and, leaning a sticky face against his chest, fell sound asleep. Servants bustled to and fro around them, smiling kindly now and then. He should, he thought vaguely, get up. Dinner would be being served in a moment. He saw the platters of roasted duck and mutton being skilfully laid out. Bowls mounded with heaps of fluffy, steaming rice soaked with gravy, and a huge salad of greens being tossed with vinegar. Filled with whiskey, bread pudding, and contentment, though, he lingered, putting off from moment to moment the necessity of parting from Jem and ending the sweet peace of holding his sleeping son. "Mr. Roger, I take him, shall I?" said a soft voice. He looked up from an examination of Jem's hair, which had bits of bread pudding stuck in it, to see Phaedra, Jocasta's body servant, stooping before him, hands held out to receive the boy. "I wash him. Put him to his bed, sir," she said, her oval face as soft as her voice as she looked at Jem. "Oh, yes, sure. Thanks." Roger sat up, Jem in his arms, and rose carefully, holding Jem's considerable weight. "Here, I'll carry him up for you." He followed the slave up the narrow stairs from the kitchen, admiring, in a purely abstract and aesthetic sort of way, the grace of her carriage. How old was she, he wondered. 20? 22? Would Jocasta allow her to marry? She must have admirers, surely. But he knew how valuable she was to Jocasta, too, seldom out of her mistress's presence. Not easy to reconcile that with a home and family of her own. At the top of the stairs she stopped and turned to take Jem from him. He surrendered his limp burden with reluctance, but also with some relief. It was stifling hot down below, and his shirt was damp with sweat where Jem had pressed against him. "Mr. Roger?" Phaedra's voice stopped him as he was about to take his leave. She was looking at him over Jem's shoulder, eyes hesitant beneath the white curve of her headscarf. "Aye?" The thump of feet coming up the stairs made him move, narrowly avoiding Oscar, charging upstairs with an empty platter under his arm, evidently bound for the summer kitchen, where the fish were being fried. Oscar grinned at Roger as he passed, and blew a kiss toward Phaedra, whose lips tightened at the gesture. She made a slight motion with her head, and Roger followed her down the hall, away from the bustle of the kitchen. She stopped near the door that led out to the stables, glancing round to be sure they were not overheard.
"I maybe shouldn't say nothing, sir. Maybe as it is nothing. But I'm thinking I should tell you anyway."
He nodded, shoving back the damp hair at his temple. The door stood open, and there was a little breeze here, thank God.
"We was in the town, sir, this morning, at Mr. Benjamin's warehouse. You know the one? Down by the river?"
He nodded again, and she licked her lips.
"Master Jem, he got restless and went to poking round while the mistress talked with Mr. Benjamin. I followed him, seen as he falls into no trouble, and so I was right there when the man come in."
"Aye? Which man was this?"
She shook her head, dark eyes serious.
"I don't know, sir. Was a big man, tall as you. Light-haired. He wasn't wearing no wig. Was a gentleman, though."
By which, he assumed, she meant the man was well-dressed.
"And?"
"He looks round, sees Mr. Benjamin a-talking with Miss Joe, and he takes a step to the side, like as he don't want no one taking notice he there. But then he sees Mr. Jem, and he get a sharp kind of look on his face."
She pulled Jem a little closer, recalling.
"I ain't liking that look, sir, tell you truly. I see him start toward Jemmy, and I go quick and pick the lad up, same as I got him now. The man looked surprised, then, like he thinks something's funny, he smile at Jem and ax him who his daddy be.
She gave a quick smile, patting Jem's back.
Folk ax him that all the time so downtown, and he speak right up, say his daddy Roger Mackenzie, same as he always do. This man he laugh and ruffle Jem's hair. They all do that, sir. He got such pretty hair. Then he say, "Is he then, ma wee manine? Is he indeed?"
Fedra was a natural mimic. She caught the Irish lilt of it perfectly, and the sweat turned cold on Roger's skin.
"And then what happened?" he demanded. "What did he do?"
Unconsciously, he glanced over her shoulder through the open door, searching the night outside for danger. Fedra hunched her shoulders, shivering slightly.
"He ain't do nothing, sir. But he look at Jem real close and then at me, and he smile, right in my eyes. I ain't liking that smile, sir, not one bit."
She shook her head.
"But then I hear Mr. Benjamin lift his voice behind me, calling out to say, 'Does the gentleman want him?' And the man turn quick-like on his heel, and be gone out the door just like that."
She clutched Jem with one arm and snapped the fingers of her free hand briefly.
"I see."
The bread pudding had formed a solid mass that lay like iron in his stomach.
"Did you say anything to your mistress about this man?"
She shook her head, solemn.
"No, sir. He ain't really done nothing, like I say. But he trouble me, sir, and so I study on it, coming home, and think finally, well, I best tell you, sir, and I gets the chance."
"You did right," he said. "Thank you, Fed."
He fought the urge to take Jem from her, hold him tight.
"Would you, when you've got him to bed, will you stay with him? Just until I come up. I'll tell your mistress I asked you to."
Her dark eyes met his with perfect understanding, and she nodded.
"Aye, sir. I keep him safe."
She bobbed the shadow of a curtsy and went up the stairs toward the room he shared with Jem, humming something soft and rhythmic to the boy. He breathed slowly, trying to master the overwhelming urge to seize a horse from the stables, ride to Cross Creek, and search the place, going from house to house in the dark until he found Stephen Bonnet.
"Right," he said aloud. "And then what?"
His fists curled up involuntarily, knowing quite well what to do, even as his mind acknowledged the futility of such a course. He fought down rage and helplessness, the last of the whiskey lighting his blood, throbbing in his temples. He stepped abruptly through the open door into the night, for it was full dark now. From this side of the house the meadow was invisible, but he could still smell the smoke of their fires and catch the faint trill of music on the air. He'd known Bonnet would come again, one day. Down beside the lawn, the white bulk of Hector Cameron's mausoleum was a pale smear on the night, and safe inside it, hidden in the coffin that waited for Hector's wife, Jocasta, lay a fortune in Jacobite gold, the long-held secret of River Run. Bonnet knew the gold existed, suspected it was on the plantation. He had tried for it once before, and failed. He was not a careful man, Bonnet, but he was persistent. Roger felt his bones strain in his flesh, urgent with desire to hunt and kill the man who had raped his wife, threatened his family. But there were 76 people depending on him. No, 77. Vengeance warred with responsibility, and, most reluctantly, gave way. He breathed slow and deep, feeling the knot of the rope scar tighten in his throat. No, he had to go, to see the new tenants safe. The thought of sending them with Arch and Tom while he remained behind to search for Bonnet was tempting. But the job was his. He couldn't abandon it for the sake of a time-consuming, and likely futile, personal quest. Nor could he leave Jem unprotected. He must tell Duncan, though. Duncan could be trusted to take steps for the protection of River Run, to send word to the authorities in Cross Creek, to make inquiries. And Roger would make sure that Jem was safe away, too, come morning, held before him on his saddle, kept in his sight every inch of the way to the sanctuary of the mountains.
"Who's your daddy?" he muttered, and a fresh surge of rage pulsed through his veins. "God damn it, I am, you bastard!"
Part 3. To everything there is a season. Chapter 16. Le mot juste. August, 1773.
"You're smiling to yourself," Jamie said in my ear. "Nice, was it?"
I turned my head and opened my eyes, finding them on a level with his mouth, which was smiling too.
"Nice," I said thoughtfully, tracing the line of his wide lower lip with the tip of one finger. "Are you being deliberately modest, or are you hoping to inspire me to raptures of praise by means of classic understatement?"
The mouth widened further, and his teeth closed gently on my questing finger for a moment before releasing it.
"Oh, modesty, to be sure," he said. "If I'd hopes of inspiring you to raptures, it wouldn't be with my words now, would it?"
One hand ran lightly down my back in illustration.
"Well, the words help," I said.
"They do?"
"Yes. Just now I was actually trying to rank I love you, I like you, I worship you. I have to have my cock inside you, in terms of their relative sincerity."
"Did I say that?" he said, sounding slightly startled.
"Yes. Weren't you listening?"
"No," he admitted. "I meant every word of it, though."
His hand cupped one buttock, weighing it appreciatively.
"Still do come to that."
"What, even the last one?" I laughed and rubbed my forehead gently against his chest, feeling his jaw rest snugly on top of my head.
"Oh, aye," he said, gathering me firmly against him with a sigh. "I will see the flesh requires a bit of supper and a wee rest before I think of doing it again. But the spirit is always willing. God, you have the sweetest fat wee bum. Only seeing it makes me want to give it to you again directly. It's lucky you're wed to a decrepit old man, Sassenach, or you'd be on your knees with your ass in the air this minute."
He smelled delectably of road dust and dried sweat, and the deep musk of a man who has just enjoyed himself thoroughly.
"Nice to be missed," I said contentedly into the small space beneath his arm. "I missed you too."
My breath tickled him, and his skin shivered suddenly, like a horse shedding flies. He shifted a bit, turning me so that my head fit into the hollow of his shoulder, and sighed in matching content.
"Well, so, I see the place is still standing."
It was. It was late afternoon, the windows open, and the sun came low through the trees to make shifting patterns on the walls and the linen sheets, so that we floated in a bower of murmuring shadow leaves.
"The house is standing, the barley is mostly in, and nothing's died," I said, settling myself comfortably to report. Now that we'd taken care of the most important thing, he'd want to know how the ridge had fared in his absence.
"Mostly," he said, neatly catching the dicey bit. "What happened? It rained, aye, but the barley should all have been in a week before."
"Not rain. Grasshoppers." I shuddered in memory. A cloud of the nasty, goggle-eyed things had come whirring through just at the end of the barley harvest. I'd gone up to my garden to pick greens, only to discover said greens seething with wedge-shaped bodies and shuffling clawed feet, my lettuces and cabbages gnawed to ragged nubbins, and the morning glory vine on the palisade hanging in shreds. I ran and got Mrs. Bug and Lizzie, and we drove them off with brooms, but then they all rose up in a big cloud and headed up through the wood to the field beyond the green spring. They settled in the barley. You could hear the chewing for miles. It sounded like giants walking through rice. Goosebumps of revulsion rose on my shoulders, and Jamie rubbed my skin absently, his hand large and warm.
"Mm-hmm. Was it only the one field they got, then?"
"Oh, yes." I took a deep breath, still smelling the smoke.
"We torched the field and burnt them alive."
His body jerked in surprise and he looked down at me.
What? Who thought of that?
I did, I said, not without pride.
In cold-blooded retrospect, it was a sensible thing to have done. There were other fields at risk, not only of barley, but of ripening corn, wheat, potatoes and hay, to say nothing of the garden patches most families depended on. In actual fact, it had been a decision made in boiling rage, sheer bloody-minded revenge for the destruction of my garden. I would happily have ripped the wings off each insect and stamped on the remains. Burning them had been nearly as good, though. It was Murdo Lindsay's field. Slow in both thought and action, Murdo hadn't had time to react properly to my announcement that I meant to fire the barley, and was still standing on the stoop of his cabin, mouth hanging open, as Brianna, Lizzie, Masali, Mrs. Bug, and I ran round the field with arms full of faggots, lighting them from torches, and hurling the blazing sticks as far as we could out into the sea of ripe, dry grain. The dry grass went up with a crackle, and then a roar as the fire took hold. Confused by the heat and smoke of a dozen fires, the grasshoppers flew up like sparks, igniting as their wings caught fire, and vanishing into the rising column of smoke and whirling ash. Of course, it would be just then that Roger chose to arrive with the new tenants, I said, repressing an urge to laugh inappropriately at the memory. Poor things! It was getting dark, and here they all were, standing in the woods with their bundles and children, watching this bally conflagration going on, and all of us dancing round barefoot with our shifts curtled up, hooting like gibbons and covered with soot.
Jamie covered his eyes with one hand, plainly visualizing the scene. His chest shook briefly, and a wide grin spread beneath the hand.
Oh, God! They must have thought Roger Mac had brought them to hell, or to a coven meeting at least.
A bubble of guilty laughter was forcing itself up from under my ribs. They did. Oh, Jamie, the looks on their faces! I lost my grip and buried my own face in his chest. We shook together for a moment, laughing almost soundlessly. I did try to make them welcome, I said, snorting a little. We gave them supper and found them all places to sleep, as many as we could fit in the house, the rest spread between Brianna's cabin, the stable, and the barn. I came down quite late at night, though. I couldn't sleep for all the excitement, and found a dozen of them praying in the kitchen. They had been standing in a circle near the hearth, hands linked and heads bowed reverently. All the heads had snapped up at my appearance, eyes showing white in thin, haggard faces. They'd stared at me in total silence, and one of the women had let go the hand of the man beside her to hide her own hand under her apron. In another time and place, I should have thought she was reaching for some weapon, and perhaps she was at that. I was fairly sure she was making the sign of the horns beneath the shelter of the ragged cloth. I'd already discovered that only a few of them spoke English. I asked in my halting Gaelic whether they needed anything. They stared at me as though I had two heads. Then, after a moment, one of the men, a wizened creature with a thin mouth, had shaken his head the barest inch. Then they went right back to their praying, leaving me to skulk off back to bed.
You went down in your shift?
Well, yes.
I didn't expect anyone to be awake at that hour.
His knuckles grazed my breast, and I could tell exactly what he was thinking. My summer night rail was thin, worn linen, and yes, all right, damn it, I suppose one could see through it a bit in the light. But the kitchen had been lit only by the ruddy glow of a smoured hearth.
At dinner, suppose you went down in a proper nightcap, Sasnach?
Jamie asked, running a thoughtful hand through my hair. I'd loosened it to go to bed with him, and it was writhing off merrily in all directions, a la Medusa.
Of course not. I had it plaited, though, I protested. Quite respectable.
Oh, quite, he agreed, grinning,
and pushing his fingers up into the wild mass of my hair, cradled my head in his hands and kissed me. His lips were chapped from wind and sun, but agreeably soft. He hadn't shaved since his departure, and his beard was short and curly, springy to the touch.
"Well, Sue, they're sorted now, I expect. The tenants."
His lips brushed my cheek and nibbled gently at my ear. I inhaled deeply.
"Ah. Oh, yes.
Archbug took them off in the morning. He's got them parcelled out with families all over the ridge and already working on it." My train of thought temporarily derailed, and I closed my fingers by reflex in the muscle of his chest.
"And you told Murdo I'd make it right with him, of course. About the barley?"
"Yes, of course." My drifting attention snagged momentarily, and I laughed. He just stared at me, and then nodded in a dazed sort of way, and said,
"Oh, just as himself liked, to be sure." I don't know if he realized even then why I'd burnt his field. Perhaps he just thought I'd taken a sudden fancy to set fire to his barley.
Jamie laughed, too, a most unsettling sensation, as he had his teeth fixed in my earlobe. I said faintly, feeling the tickle of red beard on my neck and the very warm, firm flesh beneath my palm.
"The Indians. How did you manage with the Cherokee?"
"Fine."
He moved suddenly, rolling over on top of me. He was very big and very warm, and he smelled of desire, strong and sharp. The leafy shadows moved across his face and shoulders, dappled the bed and the white skin of my thighs opened wide.
"I like you fine, Sassenach," he murmured in my ear. "I can see you there, half naked in your shift and your hair down, curling over your breast."
"I love you. I wore..."
"What was that about a rest and supper?" His hands were worming themselves under me, cupping my buttocks, squeezing, his breath soft and hot on my neck.
"I have to have my..."
"But..."
"Now, Sassenach."
He rose up abruptly, kneeling on the bed before me. There was a faint smile on his face, but his eyes were dark blue and intent. He cupped his heavy balls in one hand, the thumb moving up and down his exigent member in a slow and thoughtful manner.
"On your knees, Anian," he said softly. "Now..."
Chapter 17. The Limits of Power.
From James Fraser, Esquire, Fraser's Ridge, to Lord John Grey of Mount Josiah Plantation. August 14th, 1773. "My Lord, I write to inform you of my new office, namely that of Indian Agent to the Crown, by appointment to the Southern Department under John Stuart. I was originally of two minds regarding acceptance of this appointment, but found my views made more singular by reason of a visit by Mr. Richard Brown, a distant neighbour, and his brother. I expect that Mr. Higgins will already have given you an account of their so-called Committee of Safety and its immediate object of arresting him. Have you encountered such ad hoc bodies in Virginia? I think perhaps your situation is not so unsettled as is our own, or that in Boston, where Mr. Higgins also reports their presence. I hope it is not. I think a person of sense must deplore these committees in principle. Their stated purpose is to provide protection from vagabonds and banditti, and to arrest criminals in those areas where no sheriff or constable is available. With no law to regulate their behaviour, save self-interest, though, plainly, there is nothing to prevent an irregular militia from becoming more of a threat to the citizenry than the dangers from which it offers to preserve them. The appeal is plain, though, particularly in such case as we find ourselves here, so remotely situated. The nearest courthouse is, or was,
3 days' ride, and in the constant unrest that has followed the regulation, matters have decayed even from this unsatisfactory state. The governor and his council are in constant conflict with the assembly. The circuit court has effectively ceased to exist. Judges are no longer appointed, and there is no sheriff of Surrey County at present, the latest holder of that office having resigned under threat of having his house fired. The sheriffs of Orange and Rowan counties still boast office, but their corruption is so well known that no one may depend upon them, save those whose interest is invested in them. We hear frequent reports these days of house burnings, assaults, and similar alarms in the wake of the recent war of regulation. Governor Tryon officially pardoned some of those involved in the conflict, but did nothing to prevent local retribution against them. His successor is still less able to deal with such events, which are, in any case, occurring in the back country, far from his palace in New Bern, and thus the more easily ignored. In all justice, the man doubtless has troubles nearer at hand to deal with. Still, while settlers here are accustomed to defend themselves from the normal threats of the wilderness, the occurrence of such random attacks as these, and the possibility of eruption of the Indians, so close to the treaty line, is sufficient to unnerve them, and cause them to greet with relief the appearance of anybody willing to undertake the role of public protection. Hence the vigilantes of the committees are welcomed, at least to begin with. I give you so much detail by way of explaining my thoughts regarding the appointment. My friend Major MacDonald, late of the 32nd Cavalry, had told me that should I ultimately decline to become an Indian agent, he would approach Mr. Richard Brown, Brown being in the way of doing substantial trade with the Cherokee, and thus in a position of acquaintance and presumed trust that would predispose his acceptance by the Indians. My acquaintance with Mr. Brown and his brother inclines me to regard this prospect with alarm. With such rise in influence as such an appointment would bring, Brown's stature in this unsettled region might shortly become so great that no man could easily oppose him in any venture. And that, I think, is dangerous. My son-in-law astutely observes that a man's sense of morality tends to decrease as his power increases, and I suspect that the brothers Brown possess relatively little of the former to begin with. It may be mere hubris on my part to assume that I have more. I have seen the corrosive effects of power upon a man's soul, and I have felt its burden, as you will understand, having borne it so often yourself. Still, if it is a choice between myself and Richard Brown, I suppose I must resort to the old Scottish adage that the devil you ken is better than the devil you don't. I am likewise made uneasy at the thought of the long absences from home which my new duties must require. And yet I cannot, in conscience, allow the people under my dominion to be subject to the vagaries and possible injuries of Brown's committee. I could, of course, convene my own such committee. I think you would urge such a course, but will not. Beyond the inconvenience and expense of such a move, it would be tantamount to declaring open war with the Browns. And I think that not prudent, not if I must be frequently away from home, leaving my family unprotected. This new appointment, though, will extend my own influence and, I trust, put some limit to the Browns' ambitions. So having reached this decision, I sent word at once to accept the appointment and essayed my first visit to the Cherokee in the office of Indian agent during the last month. My initial reception was most cordial, and I hope my relations with the villagers will remain so. I shall visit the Cherokee again in the autumn. If you should have any matters of business that my new office might assist, send to me regarding them, and rest assured that I shall make every effort on your behalf. To more domestic matters. Our small population has nearly doubled as the result of an influx of settlers newly arrived from Scotland. While most desirable, this incursion has caused no little turmoil, the newcomers being fisher folk from the coast. To these, the mountain wilderness is full of threat and mystery, such threats and mysteries being personified by pigs and ploughshares. With regard to pigs, I am not sure but that I share their views. The white sow has lately taken up residence beneath the foundation of my house, and there engages in such debauches that our dinner is disturbed daily by hellish noises resembling the sounds of souls in torment. These souls apparently being torn limb from limb and devoured by demons beneath our feet. Since I speak of matters hellish, I must observe that our newcomers are also, alas, stern sons of the Covenant, to whom a papist, such as myself, presents himself as one fully furnished with horns and tail. You will recall one Thomas Christie, I think, from Ardsmuir. By comparison of these stiff-necked gentlemen, Mr. Christie appears the soul of compassionate generosity. I had not thought to thank Providence for the fact that my son-in-law is Presbyterian by inclination, but I see now how true it is that the Almighty does indeed have designs beyond the ken of us poor mortals. While even Roger Mackenzie is a sadly depraved libertine by their lights, the new tenants are at least able to speak to him without the necessity of small gestures and signs intended to repel evil, which are the constant accompaniment to their conversations with myself. As for their behaviour with respect to my wife, you would think her the witch of Endor, if not the great whore of Babylon. This is because they consider the furnishments of her surgery to be enchantments, and were appalled at witnessing the entrance therein of a number of Cherokee, gaily festooned for visiting, who had come to trade in such arcana as snakes' fangs and the gall-bladders of bears. My wife begs me express her pleasure at your kind compliments regarding Mr. Higgins' improved health, and still more, at your offer to procure medicinal substances for her from your friend in Philadelphia. She bids me send you the enclosed list. As I cast an eye upon this, I suspect that your supplying of her desires will do nothing to allay the suspicions of the fisherfolk. But pray, do not desist on that account, as I think nothing save time and custom will decrease their fears of her. My daughter, likewise, bids me express her gratitude for your present of the phosphorus. I'm not certain that I share this sentiment, given that her experiments with the substance prove frighteningly incendiary to date. Fortunately, none of the newcomers observed these experiments, or they would be in no doubt that Satan is indeed a particular friend to me and mine. In happier vein, I congratulate you upon your latest vintage, which is indeed drinkable. I send in return a jug of Mrs. Bug's best cider, and a bottle of the barrel-aged three-year-old, which I flatter myself you will find less corrosive to the gullet than the last batch. Your obedient servant, J. Fraser. Postscriptum. I have had report of a gentleman who by description resembles one Stephen Bonnet, this man appearing briefly in Cross Creek last month. If it was indeed the gentleman, his business is unknown, and he seems to have vanished without trace. My uncle-in-law, Duncan Innes, has made inquiries in the area, but write to tell me that these have proved fruitless. Should you hear of anything in this regard, I pray you will advise me at once.
Chapter 18.
Vroom!
From the Dream Book. Last night I dreamed of running water. Generally this means I drank too much before I went to bed, but this was different. The water was coming from the faucet in the sink at home. I was helping Mama do the dishes. She was running hot water from the hose sprayer over the plates, then handing them to me to dry. I could feel the hot china through the dish towel and feel a mist of water on my face. Mama's hair was curling up like mad because of the humidity, and the pattern on the plates was the lumpy pink roses of the good wedding china. Mama didn't let me wash that until I was 10 or so, for fear I'd drop it. And when I got to wash it at last, I was so proud. I can still see every last thing in the china cabinet in the living room. Mama's great-grandfather's hand-painted cake stand. He was an artist, she said, and won a competition with that cake stand 100 years ago. The dozen crystal goblets that Daddy's mother left him, along with the cup-glass olive dish, and the cup and saucer hand-painted with violets and gilt rims. I was standing in front of it, putting away the china. But we didn't keep the china in that cabinet. We kept it in the shelf over the oven. And the water was overflowing from the sink in the kitchen and running out across the floor, puddling round my feet. Then it started to rise, and I was sloshing back and forth to the kitchen, kicking up the water so it sparkled like the cut-glass olive dish. The water got deeper and deeper, but nobody seemed to be worried. I wasn't. The water was warm, hot, in fact. I could see steam rising off it. That's all there was to the dream. But when I got up this morning, the water in the basin was so cold I had to warm water in a pan on the fire before I washed Jemmy. All the time I was checking the water on the fire, I kept remembering my dream, and all those gallons and gallons of hot, running water. What I wonder is, these dreams I have about then, they seem so vivid and detailed, more than the dreams I have about now. Why do I see things that don't exist anywhere except inside my brain? What I wonder about the dreams is, all the new inventions people think up, how many of those things are made by people like me, like us? How many inventions are really memories of the things we once knew? And how many of us are there? It isn't really that hard to have hot running water, in theory.
No, I suppose not.
Roger only half heard, concentrated as he was on the object taking shape beneath his knife. I mean, it would be a big, horrible job to do, but it's simple in concept. Dig ditches or build sluices. And around here, it would probably be sluices.
It would.
Here was the tricky part. He held his breath, chiselling delicate tiny slivers of wood away, one shaving at a time. No metal, Bree said patiently. If you had metal, you could make surface pipes. But I bet there isn't enough metal in the whole colony of North Carolina to make the piping you'd need to bring water from the creek to the big house, let alone a boiler. And if there was, it would cost a fortune.
Hmm.
Feeling that this wasn't, perhaps, an adequate response, Roger added hastily,
But there's some metal available. Jamie's still, for instance.
His wife snorted.
Yeah.
I asked him where he got it. He said he won it in a high-stakes game of loo against the ship's captain in Charleston. Think I could travel 400 miles to bet my silver bracelet against a few hundred feet of rolled copper? One more sliver. Two. The smallest scrape with the tip of the knife. Ah. The tiny circle came free of the matrix. It turned.
Sure,
he said belatedly, realizing that she'd asked him a question.
Why not?
She burst out laughing. You haven't heard one single word I've said, have you?
Oh, sure I have, he protested. Ditch, you said. And water. I'm sure I remember that one.
She snorted again, though mildly. Well, you'd have to do it anyway.
Do what?
His thumb sought the little wheel and set it spinning. Gamble. No one's going to let me into a high-stakes card game.
Thank God, he said, in reflex.
Bless your little Presbyterian heart, she said tolerantly, shaking her head. You're not any kind of gambler, Roger, are you?
Oh, And you are, I suppose.
He said it jokingly,
wondering, even as he did so, why he should feel vaguely reproached by her remark. She merely smiled at that, wide mouth curving in a way that suggested untold volumes of wicked enterprise. He felt a slight sense of unease at that. She was a gambler, though so far...
He glanced involuntarily at the large charred spot in the middle of the table.
"That was an accident," she said defensively.
"Oh, aye. At least your eyebrows have grown back."
"Humph! I'm nearly there. One more batch."
"That's what you said last time."
He was aware that he was treading on dangerous ground, but seemed unable to stop.
She took a slow, deep breath, gazing at him through slightly narrowed eyes, like one taking the range before firing off some major piece of artillery. Then she seemed to think better of whatever she'd been going to say. Her features relaxed, and she stretched out her hand toward the object he was holding.
"What's that you've been making?"
"Just a wee bobby for Jem."
He let her take it, feeling the warmth of modest pride.
"The wheels all turn."
"Mine, Daddy?"
Jemmy had been wallowing on the floor with Adso the cat, who was tolerant of small children. Hearing his name, though, he abandoned the cat, who promptly escaped through the window and popped up to see the new toy.
"Oh, look!"
Brianna ran the little car over the palm of her hand and lifted it, letting all four tiny wheels spin free. Jem grabbed eagerly for it, pulling at the wheels.
"Careful, careful! You'll pull them off. Here, let me show you."
Crouching, Roger took the car and rolled it along the hearthstones.
"See? Vroom, vroom, vroom."
"Vroom,"
Jemmy echoed.
"Let me do it, Daddy. Let me."
Roger surrendered the toy to Jemmy, smiling.
"Vroom, vroom, vroom."
The little boy shoved the car enthusiastically, then, losing his grip on it, watched open-mouthed as it zoomed to the end of the hearthstone by itself, hit the edge, and flipped over. Squealing with delight, he scampered after the new toy. Still smiling, Roger glanced up to see Brianna looking after Jem, a rather odd expression on her face. She felt his eyes on her and looked down at him.
"Vroom,"
she said quietly, and he felt a small internal jolt like a punch in the stomach.
"What's it, Daddy? What's it?"
Jemmy had recaptured the toy and ran up to him, clutching it to his chest.
"It's,
he began, helpless. It was, in fact, a crude replica of a Morris Minor, but even the word car, let alone automobile, had no meaning here. And the internal combustion engine, with its pleasantly evocative noises, was at least a century away.
"I guess it's a vroom, honey," said Bree, a distinct note of sympathy in her voice.
He felt the gentle weight of her hand resting on his head.
Yeah, that's right, he said,
and cleared a thickening in his throat.
"It's a vroom."
"Vroom,"
said Jemmy happily, and knelt to roll it down the hearth again.
"Vroom, vroom."
Steam. It would have to be steam, or wind-powered. A windmill would work, maybe, to pump water into the system. But if I want hot water, there would be steam anyway. Why not use it?
Containment is the problem. Wood burns and leaks. Clay won't hold against pressure. I need metal. That's all there is to it.
What would Mrs. Bug do, I wonder, if I took the laundry cauldron?
Well, I know what she'd do, and a steam explosion is no comparison. Besides, we do need to do the laundry.
I'll have to dream up something else.
Chapter 19. Making Hay.
Major MacDonald returned on the final day of haymaking,
I was just manoeuvring my way along the side of the house with an immense basket of bread when I saw him near the trailhead tying up his horse to a tree. He lifted his hat to me and bowed, then came across the dooryard, looking curiously round at the preparations taking place. We had set up trestles under the chestnut trees, with boards laid across them for tables, and a constant stream of women scurried to and fro like ants between the house and yard, fetching food. The sun was setting, and the men would be in soon for a celebratory feast, filthy, exhausted, starving, and exhilarated by the end of their labours. I greeted the Major with a nod, and accepted with relief his offer to carry the bread to the tables for me.
"Heeing, is it?" he said, in answer to my explanation.
A nostalgic smile spread across his weathered face.
"I remember the haymaking from when I was a lad. But that was in Scotland, aye? We'd seldom such glorious weather as this for it."
He looked up into the blazing deep blue bowl of the August sky above. It really was perfect haying weather, hot and dry. "It's wonderful," I said, sniffing appreciatively. The scent of fresh hay was everywhere.
And so was the hay. There were shimmering mounds of it in every shed. Everyone carried bits of it on their clothes, and small trails of scattered straw lay everywhere.
Now the smell of cut dry hay was mingled with the delectable scent of the barbecue that had been simmering underground overnight, the fresh bread, and the heady tang of Mrs. Bugg's cider. Massali and Bree were bringing down jugs of it from the spring house, where it had been cooling, along with buttermilk and beer.
"I see, I've chosen my time well," the Major remarked, viewing all this effort with approval.
"If you came to eat, yes," I said, rather amused. "If you came to talk to Jamie, I rather think you'll have to wait until tomorrow." He looked at me, puzzled, but had no opportunity to inquire further. I had caught another glimpse of movement at the trailhead. The Major turned, seeing the direction of my glance, and frowned slightly.
"Why, that's that fellow with a brand on his face," he said, wary disapproval in his voice. "I saw him down at Coopersville, but he saw me first, and steered well clear. Will you have me drive him off, Mum?"
He set down the bread, and was already settling his sword belt on his hip, when I gripped his forearm.
"You'll do no such thing, Major," I said sharply. "Mr. Higgins is a friend."
He gave me a flat look, then dropped his arm.
"As you like, Mrs. Fraser, of course,"
he said coolly, and picking up the bread again, went off toward the tables. Rolling my eyes in exasperation, I went to greet the newcomer. Plainly, Bobby Higgins could have joined the Major on the path to the ridge. Just as plainly, he had chosen not to. He had become a little more familiar with mules, I saw. He was riding one and leading another, laden with a promising array of panniers and boxes.
"His lordship's compliments, Mum," he said, saluting me smartly as he slid off.
From the corner of my eye, I saw MacDonald watching, and his small start of recognition at the military gesture. So, now he knew Bobby for a soldier, and doubtless would ferret out his background in short order. I repressed a sigh. I couldn't mend matters. They'd have to settle it between themselves, if there was anything to settle.
"You're looking well, Bobby," I said, smiling as I pushed aside my disquiet. "No difficulties with the riding, I hope." "Oh, no, ma'am," he beamed, "and I's not fallen out once since I left you last."
Fallen out meant fainted, and I congratulated him on the state of his health, looking him over as he unloaded the pack mule with deft efficiency. He did seem much better, pink and fresh-skinned as a child, bar the ugly brand on his cheek.
"Yonder lobster back," he said,
affecting insouciance as he set down a box.
"He's known to you, is he, Mum?"
"That's Major MacDonald," I said, carefully not looking in the Major's direction. I could feel his stare boring into my back. "Yes. He does things for the governor, I believe. Not regular army, I mean. He's a half-pay officer. That bit of information seemed to ease Bobby's mind a bit. He took a breath as though to say something, but then thought better of it. Instead, he reached into his shirt and withdrew a sealed letter, which he handed over. "That's for you," he explained, "from his lordship. Is Miss Lizzie by any chance about?"
His eyes were already searching the flock of girls and women readying the tables.
"Yes. She was in the kitchen last I saw," I replied, a small uneasy feeling skittering down my backbone. "She'll be out in a minute. But you do know she's betrothed, don't you, Bobby? Her fiancé will be coming with the other men for supper."
He met my eyes and smiled with singular sweetness.
"Why, ma'am, I knew that well enough. Only thought as I should thank her for her kindness when I last was here."
"Oh," I said, not trusting that smile in the slightest. Bobby was a very handsome lad, blind eye or not. And he had been a soldier.
"Well, good."
Before I could say more, I caught the sound of male voices coming through the trees. It wasn't precisely singing, sort of a rhythmic chant. I wasn't sure what it was. There was a lot of Gaelic "horo" and the like, but all of them seemed to be bellowing along in a cordial fashion. Haymaking was a novel concept to the new tenants, who were much more accustomed to rake kelp than scythe grass. Jamie, Arch, and Roger had shepherded them through the process, though, and I'd been asked to stitch no more than a handful of minor wounds, so I assumed it had been a success. No hands or feet lopped off. A few shouting matches, but no fist fights, and no more than the usual amount of hay trampled or ruined. All of them seemed in good spirits as they poured into the dooryard, bedraggled, sweat-soaked, and thirsty as sponges. Jamie was in the thick of them, laughing and staggering as someone pushed him. He caught sight of me, and a huge grin split his sun-browned face. In a stride, he had reached me, and swept me into an exuberant embrace, redolent of hay, horses, and sweat. "Done, by God," he said, and kissed me soundly. "Christ, I need a drink." "And nay, that's no blasphemy, wee Roger," he added with a glance behind him. "It's heartfelt gratitude and desperate need, aye?"
"Aye. First things first, though."
Roger had appeared behind Jamie, his voice so hoarse that it was barely audible in the general uproar. He swallowed, grimacing.
"Oh, aye."
Jamie shot a quick look at Roger, assessing, then shrugged and strode out into the centre of the yard.
"Eastrish! Eastrish!"
Evan and Murdo joined him, clapping their hands and shouting, "Hear him!" loudly enough that the crowd began to subside and pay attention.
"I say the prayer from my mouth. I say the prayer from my heart. I say the prayer to thee thyself, O healing hand, O son of the God of salvation."
He didn't raise his voice much above its normal speaking level, but everyone quieted at once, so the words rang clear.
"Thou, Lord God of the angels, spread over me thy linen robe, shield me from every famine, free me from every spectral shape, strengthen me in every good, encompass me in every strait, safeguard me in every ill, and from every enmity restrain me."
There was a stirring of faint approval in the crowd. I saw a few of the fisherfolk bow their heads, though their eyes stayed fixed on him.
"Be thou between me and all things grisly. Be thou between me and all things mean. Be thou between me and all things gruesome, coming darkly toward me. O God of the weak, O God of the lowly, O God of the righteous, O shield of homesteads, thou art calling upon us in the voice of glory with the mouth of mercy of thy beloved Son."
I glanced at Roger, who was nodding slightly with approval as well. Evidently they'd agreed on it together. sensible. It would be a prayer familiar in form to the fisher folk, and nothing specifically Catholic about it.
Jamie spread his arms, quite unconsciously, and the breeze caught the worn, damp linen of his shirt as he tilted back his head and raised his face to the sky, open with joy.
O, may I find rest everlasting in the home of thy Trinity, in the paradise of the godly, in the sun garden of thy love. Amen, said Roger, as loudly as he could, and there were gratified murmurs of Amen round the yard. Then Major MacDonald raised the tankard of cider he was holding, called Flange, and drained it.
Festivity became general after that. I found myself sitting on a cask, Jamie on the grass at my feet with a platter of food and a constantly refilled mug of cider.
Bobby Higgins is here, I told him, catching sight of Bobby in the midst of a small group of admiring young ladies. Do you see Lizzie anywhere?
No,
he said, stifling a yawn.
Why?
He asked for her particularly.
Then I'm sure he'll find her. Will you have a bit of meat, Sassenach?
He held up a large rib bone, brow cocked inquiringly.
I've had some, I assured him, and he at once tore into it, addressing himself to the vinegar-spiced barbecue as though he hadn't eaten for a week.
Has Major MacDonald spoken to you?
No,
he said, mouth full, and swallowed.
He'll keep. There's Lizzie. We the MacGillivrays.
I felt reassured by that. The MacGillivrays, particularly Frau Utter, would certainly discourage any inappropriate attentions to their new intended daughter-in-law. Lizzie was chatting and laughing with Robin MacGillivray, who was smiling at her in fatherly fashion, while his son, Manfred, ate and drank with single-minded appetite. Frau Utter, I saw, was keeping a sharp and interested eye on Lizzie's father, who was sitting on the porch nearby, cosily side by side, with a tall, rather plain-faced German lady. "Who's that with Joseph Weems?" I asked, nudging Jamie with my knee to direct his attention. He narrowed his eyes against the sun's glare, looking, then shrugged.
"I didn't again. She's German. She must have come with Uter MacGillivray. Matchmaking, aye?"
He tilted up his mug and drank, sighing with bliss.
"Do you think so?"
I looked at the strange woman with interest. She certainly seemed to be getting on well with Joseph, and he with her. His thin face was alight as he gestured, explaining something to her, and her neatly capped head was bent toward him, a smile on her lips. I didn't always approve of Uta MacGillivray's methods, which tended toward the juggernaut, but I had to admire the painstaking intricacy of her plans. Lizzie and Manfred would marry next spring, and I had wondered how Joseph would fare then. Lizzie was his whole life. He might, of course, go with her when she married. She and Manfred would simply live in the MacGillivray's large house, and I imagined that they would find room for Joseph too. Still, he would be torn, not wanting to leave us, and while any able-bodied man could always be of use on a homestead, he was by no means a natural farmer, let alone a gunsmith, like Manfred and his father. If he himself were to wed, though... I gave Uta MacGillivray a glance and saw her watching Mr. Weems and his inamorata with the contented expression of a puppet master whose puppets are dancing precisely to her tune. Someone had left a pitcher of cider beside us. I refilled Jamie's mug, then my own. It was wonderful. A dark, cloudy amber, sweet and pungent, and with the bite of a particularly subtle serpent to it. I let the cool liquid trickle down my throat and bloom inside my head like a silent flower. There was much talk and laughter, and I noticed that while the new tenants still kept to their own family groups, there was now a little more blending, as the men who had been working side by side for the last 2 weeks maintained their cordial relations, these social courtesies fueled by cider. The new tenants mostly regarded wine as a mocker. Strong drink, whiskey, rum or brandy, as raging. But everyone drank beer and cider.
Cider was wholesome, one of the women had told me, handing a mug to her small son. I gave it half an hour, I thought, sipping slowly, before they started dropping like flies. Jamie made a small amused sound, and I looked down at him. He nodded at the far side of the doorway, and I looked to see that Bobby Higgins had disentangled himself from his admirers, and by some alchemical legerdemain had managed to abstract Lizzie from the midst of the McGillivrays. They were standing in the shadow of the chestnut trees, talking. I looked back at the McGillivrays. Manfred was leaning against the foundation of the house, head nodding over his plate. His father had curled up beside him on the ground and was snoring peacefully. The girls chatted around them, passing food to and fro over the drooping heads of their husbands, all in various stages of impending somnolence. Uta had moved to the porch and was talking to Joseph and his companion. I glanced back. Lizzie and Bobby were only talking, and there was a respectful distance between them. But there was something about the way he bent toward her, and the way she half turned away from him, then back, swinging a fold of her skirt one-handed. "Oh, dear," I said. I shifted a little, getting my feet under me, but unsure whether I ought really to go and interrupt them. After all, they were in plain sight, and...
"Three things astonish me. Nay, four, seeth the prophet."
Jamie's hand squeezed my thigh, and I looked down to see that he was also watching the couple under the chestnut tree, his eyes half closed.
"The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent on the rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid."
"Oh, so I'm not imagining it," I said dryly. "Do you think I'd best do something?"
"Mm-hmm."
He took a deep breath and straightened up, shaking his head vigorously to wake himself.
"Ah, no, Sassenach. If we, Manfred, will not take the trouble to guard his woman, it's no your place to do it for him."
"Yes, I quite agree. I'm only thinking, if Uta should see them... or Joseph. I wasn't sure what Mr. Weems would do. I thought Uta would probably make a major scene."
"Oh."
He blinked, swaying a little.
"Aye, I suppose you're right."
He turned his head, searching, then, spotting Ian, lifted his chin in summons. Ian had been sprawled dreamily on the grass a few feet away, next to a pile of greasy rib bones, but now rolled over and crawled obligingly to us.
"Hmm,"
he said. His thick brown hair had fallen half out of its binding, and several cowlicks were sticking straight up, the rest fallen disreputably over one eye. Jamie nodded in the direction of the chestnut trees.
"Go and ask wee Lizzie to mend your hand, Ian."
Ian glanced blearily down at his hand. There was a fresh scratch across the back of it, though it was long since clotted. Then he looked in the direction Jamie indicated.
"Oh,"
he said. He remained on hands and knees, eyes narrowed thoughtfully, then rose slowly to his feet and pulled the binding off his hair. Casually shoving it back with one hand, he strolled in the direction of the chestnut trees. They were much too far away to hear anything, but we could see. Bobby and Lizzie parted like the waves of the Red Sea as Ian's tall, gangly form stepped purposefully between them. The three seemed to chat amiably for a moment, then Lizzie and Ian departed for the house, Lizzie giving Bobby a casual wave of the hand and a brief backward glance. Bobby stood for a moment, looking after her, rocking thoughtfully on his heels, then shook his head and made for the cider. The cider was taking its toll. I'd expected every man in the place to be laid out cold by nightfall. During haying, men commonly fell asleep in their plates from sheer exhaustion. As it was, there was still plenty of talk and laughter, but the soft twilight glow beginning to suffuse the dooryard showed an increasing number of bodies strewn in the grass. Rollo was gnawing contentedly on Ian's discarded bones. Brianna sat a little way away,
Roger lay with his head in her lap, sound asleep. The collar of his shirt was open, the ragged rope scar still vivid across his neck. Bree smiled at me, her hand gently stroking his glossy black hair, picking bits of hay out of it. Jemmy was nowhere to be seen. Neither was Germaine, as I ascertained with a quick look around. Luckily, the phosphorus was under lock and key in the top of my highest cupboard. Jamie laid his own head against my thigh, warm and heavy, and I put my hand on his hair, smiling back at Bree. I heard him snort faintly, and looked in the direction of his gaze.
"For such a wee lass, yon Lizzie does cause a good deal of trouble," he said.
Bobby Higgins was standing beside one of the tables, drinking cider, and quite evidently unaware that he was being stalked by the Beardsley twins. The two of them were slinking like foxes through the wood, not quite out of sight, converging on him from opposite directions. One, Joe probably, stepped out suddenly beside Bobby, startling him into spilling his drink. He frowned, wiping at the wet splotch on his shirt, while Joe leaned close, obviously muttering menaces and warnings. Looking offended, Bobby turned away from him, only to be confronted by Kezzy on the other side. "I'm not sure it's Lizzie who's causing the trouble," I said defensively. "She only talked to him, after all." Bobby's face was growing noticeably flushed. He set down the mug he'd been drinking from and drew himself up a little, one hand folding into a fist. The Beardsleys crowded closer with the evident intention of forcing him into the wood. Glancing warily from one twin to the other, he took a step back, putting a solid tree trunk at his back. I glanced down. Jamie was watching through half-closed lids with an expression of dreamy detachment. He sighed deeply, his eyes closed altogether, and he went suddenly and completely limp, the weight of him heavy against me. The reason for this sudden absquatulation loomed up a second later. MacDonald, ruddy with food and cider, his red coat glowing like a cinder in the sunset light. He looked down at Jamie, peacefully slumbering against my leg, and shook his head. He turned slowly round, surveying the scene.
"'Struth,' he said mildly. "'I'll tell you, Mum. I've seen battlefields with much less carnage.'
"'Oh, have you?' His appearance had distracted me, but at the mention of carnage, I glanced back. Bobby and the Beardsley twins had disappeared, vanished like wisps of mist in the gloaming. Well, if they were beating each other to pulp in the wood, I was sure I'd hear about it before too long. With a small shrug, MacDonald bent, took Jamie by the shoulders, and eased him off me, laying him down in the grass with surprising gentleness.
"May I?" he asked politely,
and upon my nod of assent, sat down beside me on the other side, arms companionably hooked round his knees. He was neatly dressed, as always, wig and all, but the collar of his shirt was grimy, and the skirts of his coat frayed at the hem and spattered with mud. "A great deal of travel these days, Major," I asked, making conversation. "You look rather tired, if you'll pardon my mentioning it." I had surprised him in the middle of a yawn. He swallowed it, blinking, then laughed.
"Aye, Mum. I've been in the saddle for the last month, and seen a bed, perhaps, one night in three."
He did look tired, even in the soft sunset light. The lines of his face were cut deep with fatigue, the flesh between his eyes sagging and smudged. He wasn't a handsome man, but normally had a brash self-assurance that lent him an attractive air. Now he looked what he was, a half-pay soldier pushing 50, lacking a regiment or regular duty, struggling for any small connections that might hold some hope of advancement. I wouldn't normally have spoken to him of his business, but sympathy moved me to ask, "Are you working a lot on behalf of Governor Martin these days?" He nodded and took another gulp of cider, breathing deeply after it.
"Aye, Mum. The Governor has been kind enough to charge me with bringing him news of conditions in the back country, and has done me the signal favour of accepting my advice now and then.
He glanced at Jamie, who had curled himself up like a hedgehog and commenced to snore, and smiled.
"With regard to my husband's appointment as Indian agent, you mean?"
"We do thank you, Major." He waved a casual hand in dismissal of my thanks.
"Ah, no, mum. That had nothing to do with the governor, save indirectly. Such appointments are the province of the superintendent of the southern department. Though it is, of course, a matter of interest to the governor," he added, taking another sip, "to hear news of the Indians."
"I'm sure he'll tell you all about it in the morning," I assured him, with a nod at Jamie.
"Indeed, mum."
He hesitated for a moment.
"Would you ken that Mr. Fraser perhaps mention in his conversations in the villages, was there any mention of burnings?"
I sat up straight, the cider buzz disappearing from my head. "What's happened?"